Well, now this morning, to how soil shapes our lives, including the games we play and what we grow. Australian soil scientist Elisa Bryce describes soil as a wonderful, mysterious world, an underground jungle, a nexus of a portal between life and death. In her popular science book, Grounded, she focuses on how life could not exist without soil and how it informs so much of what we do and so much beyond agriculture. Elisa Bryce joins 9 to Noon from the New South Wales town of Yeranga, which I hope I've said correctly, Elisa. Kia ora, good morning. Thank you for being with us on 9 to Noon.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. And yes, you did pronounce it correctly, Yeranga.
Yeranga. So let's just set this out. A soil scientist, what do you do? If you're asked at a dinner party, oh, what's your job? Mm-hmm. What do you do? What do you tell people?
Well, I'm a soil scientist. And as I start the book, that's usually a bit of a conversation stopper. Well, we dig a lot of holes. And there's lots of variety that a soil scientist can do. Many work in agriculture, helping farmers improve crop growth. Quite a few soil scientists help map the soil, because even though soil is everywhere, our understanding is pretty poor and we don't have amazing maps of it yet. Some work in contamination, but I took a slightly different route. I became an urban soil scientist, which is similar to agriculture in that your mission is to improve the soil or work with the soil to make plants grow as well as they can. But I was working in cities. How can we beautify and green our cities with our parks and gardens and street trees and sports fields and all of the wonderful plants that help make cities wonderful?
And we'll talk a little bit more about being an urban soil scientist, I think, a little bit later on. But for you, what is it about soil that's so fascinating? What's so great about it?
Oh, what isn't great about it? It has everything. It's got mystery. It's got romance. I think what I find most interesting about soil is the potential. The soil is full of this life and these microbes, and we don't know, say, 90% of what's down there. So that could hold, the next wonder drug. There's been some amazing research lately where there could be a replacement for morphine that was found on some marine mud on the edge of a boat ramp. There's a chemist in the US who's been working on these particular antibacterial clays that can treat a really nasty flesh-eating ulcer. I like that it is, as you said at the beginning, it's kind of the portal between life and death, where we come from the earth, nutrients and elements cycle through life, and then when we die, we return to the earth. It can be used to solve crimes. Gosh, I could go on and on. it's amazing. It's beautiful as well. It's not just brown. If you've ever seen a rammed earth wall, beautiful ochre colours or art or pottery, it's just a magical substance on which we are completely dependent.
And I suppose this is the thing that, as someone, I have to confess, I am not someone who is perhaps particularly in touch with the soil in the sense that I do have the blackest thumbs as opposed to green ones. But, if I look at soil, I see, it's just soil, it's just dirt. I guess that's not what you see. You see something completely different.
No, I see basically the foundation of life. Perhaps a more interesting way to describe it is if we did a thought experiment, which is something how I start the book and say, just imagine you're lost in a vast wilderness. I would imagine you're lost in a forest because it's easier than if you're in a desert. And think about how would you survive if the soil wasn't there and everything that the soil gives you? Could you find food? Could you find shelter? Maybe you could find a cave, but let's say you wanted to start a fire. How are you going to start that? Where's the kindling coming from? Even if you only eat carnivores, they're probably eating herbivores, which eat something which grows in the soil. All roads for life lead back to the soil. So if anyone can come up with an answer on how they could live without the soil, please let me know. Free book for you.
And so is this why you were inspired to write the book, to explore that connection with how vital the soil is?
Yes. One thing that I don't like is that soil is often presented in a very negative way. It is important, but I think that sometimes people get tired of all the bad news. And the introduction many people get is it's either quick, it's dirty, wash it off you, In Australia, in Year 4, you study erosion, and a lot of the narrative is about degradation, which is true and it is very important, but I would like people to be excited about the soil and to realize that it is fun, it is interesting, it is part of our lives in all these really great ways. And that, you know, maybe by extension, people will get excited and interested, and we might get some more soil or land care from a positive angle rather than just making people feel bad about something they might not have ever thought about before.
So the land cannot exist without soil. And that in itself highlights just how precious a resource this is.
Yes, exactly. Could life exist without the soil? Higher life? Probably not.
So I suppose archaeology is one thing, and digging into the soil and the earth is one area where people may see that, you know, this is something where humans have that interaction other than perhaps agriculture. You write in the book that soil has a memory. What do you mean by that?
Well, as we're busy living our lives and the world is turning, the soil actually records what's happening. And archaeology is fascinating. But what archaeologists tend to do is just look at the pottery shards or the evidence of human life, the pieces. But the soil itself can give you a great understanding of what was happening if you know how to look. And that can mean looking at the soil chemistry. So, for example, if you've seen the recent movie The Dig with the ship find at Sutton Hoo, where the ship was gone, but there was just an imprint left in the soil. One way that they helped understand what was going on was by testing soil chemistry, and that elevated levels of phosphates showed that there would have been a body there at some stage. There was no other clue except for just this blip in phosphorus in the soil saying something was here, and that helps add to the understanding of the site. Another great example is in Sydney, where the Museum of Sydney now stands was going to be office blocks, and it's not, because of what the soil chemistry was saying. The bicentenary is coming up, and history was a very popular topic at the time. And what the government wanted to understand was this an untouched site, or has something happened here historically that we just don't know about? And a soil scientist called Roy was doing some soil tests, and the main thing he found was that even though the soil, it looked completely untouched, it looked very normal, even to a soil scientist, but when he tested the chemistry, the pH was at 9, whereas normally it would be at 4. So it was 100,000 times higher. And what that meant was that this site was actually next to the very first government house, and firewood was the main source of fuel, and that over time, everyone had been emptied the buckets of ash out into the ground, and they had effectively over hundreds of years limed the soil. So there was history in the soil. It just wasn't visible. And I think this is really important, especially for Indigenous Australian history, is that if there aren't buildings or pottery shards, there's still great evidence in the soil. You just need to know how to look.
So it's a different way of looking, not just sort of brushing the soil off the pottery fragments, but considering what secrets the soil itself holds.
Yes, exactly. The soil chemistry is a good example. There is another one. It's quite nasty though, but from an old concentration camp in Poland, that if you just look at it, it looks like a lovely forest. But if you test the soil, there's elevated phosphorus, there's elevated iron, there's elevated mercury, which has come from bones and blood and fillings. So you can see a lot in the soil history if you just know how to look at it.
So it's really looking at it in a completely different sort of a way that, you know, and I guess we do talk about, you know, we come from the earth and to the earth we return. Mm-hmm. All roads do lead there, it would seem.
I think so. I would agree. Yep.
Because we do think about, obviously, we can grow things in soil as well. And you know, by extension, animals can graze on that. So the sort of effects that soil has on the food grown on it, whether that's crops or animals, the significance there.
Yes. Are you referring to food quality?
Well, I guess there's quality, there's flavour, there's quantity. You know, it feels like it is crucial what the animal or the plant is on, effectively, for what we get out the other end.
Yes, another way to look at that would be fit for purpose. It's delving a bit into agriculture, which is something I probably only talk about in terms of wine in the book. So maybe I'll talk about it in terms of wine, that the concept of terroir, the taste of place, does soil really influence the flavour of a wine? Because it's, you know, you read enough wine labels, which I've done, and it makes it sound like it really does. And I spoke to wine experts and vineyard managers and chemists and winemakers, and we came to the conclusion that soil does affect the underlying taste of grapes. You know, a Pinot on one side of the hill can taste different to a Pinot on the other. And a talented, trained wine maker can taste those differences, but we actually don't know. There's this big gaping hole of scientific knowledge. We don't know all the flavor compounds, what's happening in the soil to make these compounds in the grapes. So it's very exciting. There's a lot to learn.
Also, of course, some other recreation that takes place, and I guess often in the urban environment as well. We play sport and play games on the soil. Just talk us through how the effect that has and what we take from it.
Well, I think the interesting part about sport is that our sports fields are often on very highly engineered soil. One reason I like being an urban soil scientist is that you can make soil, you can create it, design a recipe and then manufacture something to suit your needs. So if you had a peak under a high-end sports field, you're not seeing good, rich black soil that you would expect, say, in a garden or in a paddock. It will look like beach sand because it's probably 90 to 95% sand, and it has been specifically designed that way to cope with the amount of foot traffic, to have really good drainage. The problem is that naturally grass doesn't grow on the beach, so the groundskeepers have a very challenging job of keeping grass alive on what is effectively beach sand. I mean, at the other end of the spectrum, you've got cricket wickets, which are, you know, really high clay content because they have to be hard and fast in order to get a good game of cricket. And that too requires very careful consideration of the type of clay and the minerals and the management to get something that the cricket players and us as spectators are happy to watch a game playing. Get it wrong, oh my goodness, the media storm. There was quite a bad example back in the late 90s where the very first test match in 123 years was called off because the wicket was deemed unsuitable. Too dangerous to play, and that had really serious ramifications for the groundskeeper behind that, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think there's a park here in Wellington, actually, where people play rugby, you know, it's sort of kids' rugby games and that kind of thing, Ian Galloway Park, which I think was the site of an old tip. So, you know, so after, you know, playing something like rugby, you know, with so much contact with the ground, the kids were told to go and, you know, make sure you have a bath and Dettol when you get home.
Oh, okay, right.
Does that send a shiver up your spine?
Yeah, a little bit. I know it is reasonably common to put sports fields on top of old landfills, but they should be capped well enough that I don't know how that one was constructed, but ideally there should be enough of a buffer with clean soil brought in that the kids aren't actually playing directly on the landfill. There should be, you know, 300-500 mil, hopefully more, of verified clean soil. So I hope that is what has happened at your site, that it is actually clean.
Yeah, you've got to hope so, haven't you? Yes. Now, you did mention earlier that soil could also hold the key, or, you know, microbes in soil could hold the key for new advances in medicine. I mean, this is extraordinary, that there's so much there that, in effect, so many of us don't yet know.
Yes, exactly. I think the estimates are, I mean, we don't know what we don't know, but the general estimates are maybe 97, 98% we haven't characterised. So there's, in terms of microbes, you know, they say there's more than billions and billions of microbes in one teaspoon of soil, and we don't know most of what's there, which is very exciting. And one way that researchers are looking to find out what could be helpful is that they look for what microbe is beating up on another microbe. So they take a sample of soil and they get the microbes and they put them in a Petri dish, for example, and little blobs grow. And let's say if there's a black blob and a white blob, and then the black blob is excreting something and the white blob is peeling away, it's almost like it's shying away. You can say the black blob has excreting something the white blob doesn't like. That black blob has something that could be useful that we could turn into a medicine, you know, an antibiotic. And that's what Rob Capon from the University of Queensland is doing. That's his methodology. What's beating up what? And I need to work out what's it excreting. And that's partly how they're finding this potential replacement for morphine.
Extraordinary stuff. Looking back in history, of course, there have been times when humans have specifically part of the story, I suppose, of whatever has occurred, has been intimate with the soil and with the land. I suppose I'm thinking of, particular invasions. You know, the invasion of Normandy and D-Day was the land was crucial there in terms of certainly some of the formations of it, and indeed things like, you know, escaping, digging out of prisoner of war camps.
Yes, actually, I think some of the most exciting soil science work was done for the Normandy, and I mean exciting in terms of terrifying, for the Normandy landings. They spent a year just trying to understand the beaches to work out the best landing site. And part of that was sending in covert soil samplers. So freezing New Year's Eve, 1943. It's you know, the Northern Hemisphere, so it's the middle of winter. And these trained special operations guys had to go in, put on their wetsuits, carry all this equipment, sneak onto the shore where there was German defences and, you know, celebrations were going on, and try and collect covert soil samples to take back to England to test, to work out, could we land, you know, tanks, could we land people, or would they just get stuck in the mud, which has happened in, you know, previous, I think the Dieppe raid. So many tanks got stuck in the mud that it was only a few hours and the battle was over. And I think you also mentioned tunnels. Basically, there are a few examples throughout history where tunnels have played a crucial part of warfare, and the soil you're on basically could make a big difference. In Vietnam, the Cu Chi tunnels are on these old alluvial soils that have lots of iron oxide, which means they set really hard, so they're great for tunneling. And these tunnels were so strong that they could even withstand, you know, 16 kilograms of charge, big explosions from the US bombs. They were being bombed from above and the tunnels survived. So it helped that the Viet Cong's guerrilla warfare actions. I think the other, I know I'm rabbiting on a bit, but the other a great example is The Great Escape, if you're familiar with that, say, movie, or at least the story. They managed to escape because, thankfully, they had this relatively easy sand to dig through. That was how tunneling could happen in silence. If you were on a different soil, say with that was more calcareous, it would be too noisy. You'd hear tunneling, but where that camp was, it was quite deep sand. So they managed to dig and hide all the sand. The trouble was that the sand underneath was really bright yellow, and the soil on top was dusty grey, so you couldn't just spread it on the top. You had the prisoners had to find ways to hide it in the garden bed so that their tunnelling wouldn't be discovered. They also had to shore it up. I think they ended up stealing hundreds of beds, planks of wood all the time, secreting them one by one to firm up the tunnels so that they didn't collapse on them while they were digging.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff, isn't it? And I suppose people also will be perhaps thinking of the tunnels, the trenches too, at sites like Gallipoli.
Yes, I don't know much about those ones, but Gallipoli itself. But if you're thinking World War One, on the Western Front, the mud. Rain and the mud, and there were sayings from, I think at the time said, "Hell is not war. Hell is mud," where soldiers thought that being stuck in the mud was worse than being shot because it just captured them, and they couldn't get rescued. It sounded quite horrific.
Now, of course, there are all manner of places where we end up hearing about soil or earth, or, you know, however we consider it. In forensics, I suppose. People will perhaps be thinking, oh, I've heard about, you know, soil, you know, where soil has been sampled because it's either been, you know, it's been crucial to the case one way or another of perhaps trying to catch a murderer, whether it's been, you know, footprints that have been preserved or indeed soil samples. What kind of examples can you think of in that area?
Okay, I'll give you the example that helped found the Centre for Forensic Science in Australia. And that was where a mother and a grandmother were missing and the police had their suspect. Well, he'd been found 200 kilometres away from his home, but they'd also found a car and it had boots and a shovel and a knife covered in mud and blood. So they were fairly certain something nefarious had happened, but they couldn't find these women. They could be anywhere from their home to 200 kilometres away. So they brought in Rob Fitzpatrick, soil scientist, now forensic soil scientist, and he studied the soil on, let's say, the shovel, and he looked at the colour and the minerals. So, and it was, you know, yellowish pink colour. It was acidic. It was not salty. And like, okay, that helped narrow down the area where, you know, this digging had taken place. It also didn't have any organic matter or, you know, plant roots, something you'd expect in the topsoil, which, you know, is another clue that maybe this is where the topsoil has been removed. So putting all these clues together, he narrowed the search area down for the police to a quarry only a few kilometres from the suspect's house. And he chose a particular area in a puddle and just said, you know, pinpointed an area, start here. Unfortunately, it would have been raining and they couldn't find anything. But 3 weeks later, one particular police officer was really confident in this assessment and he went back every day. And 3 weeks later, they found a hand sticking up out of the mud. So by connecting the evidence on the shovel to the soil maps and where the soil like that might be present, they managed to find the women and the suspect was convicted. I would also like to say there are also less grim examples. There was a perfume substitution case where there's $2 million of perfume left Paraguay, but it arrived at its destination as sand. And a forensic geologist had to work out where the substitution had taken place. At some point, someone had taken the perfume and replaced it with sand because no one insurance company wanted to pay. And it turned out that he traveled the route, followed the route backwards from where the perfume had gone, it had actually never left Paraguay because he found similar sand at the construction of a new dam. So whoever had done it had been right at the beginning, had snuck away in the night, taken the perfume, filled the crates with sand and sent it off on its way.
That's fascinating, isn't it, that you're able to nail it like that?
Yeah.
Now, you know, a lot of people also will be thinking, you know, that we do return to the earth. Mm-hmm. Whether we're buried or cremated or have an eco-funeral of whatever kind, what impact does that have on the soil in the local area?
Well, modern funerals are not exactly eco-friendly, especially in Australia. A grass cemetery, you know, keeping healthy green grass requires a lot of time and effort. Water, the pesticides and herbicides, basically to keep a nice-looking cemetery. Not to mention coffins, they're not necessarily just timber. There's glues and acids and things that can leach into the soil. So, I mean, that's funerals. Cremations do release a lot of carbon dioxide, and then, you know, scattering ashes is excellent ceremonially, but not horticulturally, because ashes are actually a lot of calcium and phosphorus. And if too many people scatter ashes in the one place, it changes soil chemistry, and then weeds can grow and natives can get unhappy. So, what some people are doing are looking at more eco-friendly ways of doing death. And the two that I talk about in the book are natural burials and human composting, which has been legalized in the US. And it is what it sounds like, where, you know, you're the source of nutrients and the carbon source goes in, then there's water and turning. And at the end, you come out as a quite a large volume of compost that can be used to rehabilitate land. It can take a while to get your head around it, but it's a nice idea. You know, we come from the earth, we can return to the earth. The other one is natural burials, and that's more without the coffin, but imagine a shroud, and In Australia, there's one example where they're looking for degraded land. And so if it becomes a natural burial site, it can't be developed. So the wilderness will be protected. And they're looking to rehabilitate the land by burying people without, only in a shroud, nothing else. And then planting, say, wildflowers or native shrubs above, and getting a win-win-win for people and the environment that way.